So we'd like to thank Karen and Jake Abelovitz for sponsoring this morning's Locks and Learn in memory of Jake's beloved parents, Eliyahu ben Abba and Leah Bas Avram, and Karen's brother, Yehoshua ben Shimon Dov. The neshama should have an Aliyah. So we are almost done with these two Mishnayos that we have spent weeks, if not months on, not counting. I think today we're going to wrap it up. So if you remember, and if you don't, it's right in front of you in the source sheets, from the you should have two pages. One should be a stapled page with the chimpanzees on it, and the other should be your regular Hebrew sources over here. So if you start with your regular Hebrew sources, our Mishnah told us, or Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai told his students to go out and see what is the Derech Yishar, what is the straight path that a person should cling to. And we saw five answers. We've elaborated on four, and today we will elaborate on the fifth. The first one is Rabbi Eliezer says, Ayin Tova, good eye. Rabbi Yeshua says, Chaver Tova, good friend. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Shachin Tova, good neighbor. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Haroa Es Hanolad, the ability to see what is going to happen. The English translation here is a commentary, not just a translation, as they add in brackets words to make you understand what they think it means. And again, it's not far-fetched, but just be careful whenever you deal with translations to know the difference between translating and actually commenting. So not all translations lend themselves to, not all words in Hebrew lend themselves, or phrases lend to direct translation. And by definition, a lot of translators add their own tweak into what they're saying. So this translation here, this is from the Sansino Gemara, or Perkei Avos here on the Mishnayos. Rabbi Shimon said, one who looks, brackets, ahead to see, end brackets, what, brackets, consequences, end brackets, shall be brought forth, brackets, by his own actions, end brackets. Right? We have to add a lot of words in there to understand what the sentence means. In Hebrew, if you would just translate it, haroa means to be able to see, es hanolad, that which has occurred or will have occurred. We'll see, it's an awkward phrasing in a moment. We'll see some of the commentators on that. Rabbi Elazar said, Lev Tov, a good heart, and then Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says he likes Rabbi Elazar's answer. Now, the Mishnah continues and tells us the flip question. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked him, we're still in that first source there in the boxes, Amar lahem tsu'uru ezu derech ra'a shisrachek mimenu adam. Go look to see what the bad path is. So we cover the good path. What's the bad path? So Rabbi Eliezer says, ayin ra'a, which is the flip, the opposite of ayin tova. Rabbi Yeshua omer chaver tov, good friend, excuse me, chaver ra, which is the opposite of chaver tov, good friend, bad friend. Rabbi Yossi omer, shachin ra, bad neighbor, which is the opposite of good neighbor. Skip Rabbi Shimon for a second and go to the next bullet. Rabbi Lazar omer lev ra, bad heart, which is the opposite of lev tov. So you would expect, if going back to Rabbi Shimon, if Rabbi Shimon said that the character trait or the path that you should follow is seeing the future, what should be the path that you should stay away from? What would be the converse of that? Not seeing the future. Right? So he should say, Eino roa es anola. That's not what he says. So what does he say? Now let's go back to where with that bullet point that we skipped. Rabbi Shimon Omer halove ve'eino mishalim. What is the path that you should stay away from? Somebody who who borrows and doesn't pay back. Halove ve'eino mishalim. Very, again, not the opposite, but also very specific. Very, like, I'm asking you for a big picture idea here to stay away from. What's my big picture idea? Somebody who borrows and doesn't pay back. To me, sounds very small, right? Limited. Only a few people that might be relevant to. So then the Mishnah elaborates also something that it doesn't do on the other context. It says, Echad halove mina adam kilove mina makom. When you borrow from man, from people, it's as if kilove, it's the equivalent of borrowing from God, Baruch Hu, hamakom Baruch Hu. Shneamar lo verasha velo yishalem v'tzadik chonen v'nosin. So somebody who, the pasuk in Tehillim says that somebody who borrows and doesn't pay back is considered wicked, and somebody who pays back is considered a tzaddik, and somebody who gives, tzaddik, the righteous, deal and gracious, and giveth, etc. Okay, so again, a little bit of elaboration. I'm not sure we're going to spend so much time on that. We'll see one of the commentators does give a little bit of an explanation of why it elaborates. But our big picture question here is, what's going on? First of all, what does it mean, roes anola, the ability to foresee into the future? What is the point? What is the message? And then secondly, why is the converse not add up exactly? What does this mean? Why does he say lo ve ve'eino mishalim? So let's start with source number two here, Rabbeinu Yonah. Skip the Rambam and go to Rabbeinu Yonah. So it's the bottom, right on the bottom of the page there. Everybody see it? So Reb Shimon Omer haroes anola. So what does it mean to be able to foresee the future? Shinosen einav al kol davar. You should put your eyes on everything. And by eyes here he means, presumably, your mind. V'roa kol hadvarim hanoladim kodem sheyoldu. You should be able to foresee all of the things that will happen before they actually happen. U'kishiroa davar sheyesh schar betchilaso. Visofo mevi li dehefsed misrachek mimenu. Huge Musar point right here that is found dozens of places, all over the Torah, all over Chazal. If you see something that's short-term gratification, short-term pleasure, short-term benefit, but in the long term, the consequences will be negative, will be bad, stay far away from it. Right? This is really like the crux of part of the human problem. What? Right. So your ability to be able to delay gratification, right? So the famous, might as well quote it, the marshmallow test by Walter Mischel. It's a famous, famous psychological test back in the, I believe, late 60s, early 70s. I forgot exactly the date of the first test, but they're still following up on studies to this point. And if you go on YouTube and you Google, you go YouTube and search marshmallow test, you'll see incredibly cute videos. And basically what the test is that you take 3, 4, 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds, different age groups, but young kids, you put them in a room and you tell them you put a marshmallow in front of them. And you tell them if you eat this marshmallow, you can eat it. I'm not going to stop you from eating this marshmallow. But I'm going to leave the room, and if you don't eat the marshmallow, by the time I come back, I'll give you a second marshmallow. So are you going to eat the marshmallow right now and you only get one? Or are you going to be able to delay your gratification and have that self-control to be able to earn that second marshmallow? And it's fascinating. You watch the videos of these cute little kids, and they're like staring at the marshmallow, they're sniffing the marshmallow, they're like, you know, putting it in their mouth and like taking it out, and they're like really struggling to hold it. Some eat, some don't eat. But what they found was they tracked these kids for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and the kids who were able to wait did better on average. Again, this is not a prediction guaranteed, but on average did better than the kids who weren't able to wait. They had higher GPAs, they had higher success in jobs, better relationships. That ability to delay gratification, the ability to say, even though it feels good now and it looks good now, but I can delay it and I'll get more reward. Again, that's a choice. Do I go to work now out of college, before college, or do I delay it and get a degree? Do I go out of college, rather, get a second degree? It's a similar question about how much am I able to push off what's good for, what seems to be immediately good for me now, in order to obtain a better future. That's the message Rabbeinu Yonah says of a roas anolad. You're able to see that in the future it will be better, even though it feels good now, and I can, it's not just a knowledge. I want to make that clear. It's not just, I can see that, oh, I understand that I will get 2 marshmallows in 10 minutes. But I don't care, and I'm going to eat the marshmallow right now. So it's not just an ability to see, it's an ability to control. It's an ability to make decisions based on this long-term vision, this long-term goal. No, that's not correct. It's not fully developed, completely developed until your 20s. For some people, yeah, it gets fully developed later on in life, and 20s. So that's why younger children take more risks. Teenagers take more risks. They don't see the long-term consequences. Correct. It has to be developed, and it could be trained. To some people are better at it. Some people are not better at it. Some of this is genetic. Some of it's trained, etc. The goal here is that Rabbeinu Yonah is trying to tell us is that this is a midah, that if we can incorporate this, this big picture. Right? Remember we said that, like, it's sort of minimum. It seems to be limited. Lo v'vena mashalim. This isn't limited. This is big picture. If you're able to inculcate this trait within you through, you know, training, hard work, etc., you will do that much better in life, and you'll do that much better in serving God. Right? Any mitzvah, you're basically saying, I can do something much easier and much pleasurable right now. I can watch TV or I can learn Torah. Right? Maybe the learning Torah, sometimes it's pleasurable, it's great. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's difficult. So do I take the easy way out now, or do I put in the investment so that later there'll be higher dividends? Okay? So that's lesson number one that we should take away from Rabbeinu Yonah. Continuing, uvizeh lo yechtal olam. So now he's putting he's limiting it now to some extent. And he's saying that what's the benefit of this? Not that you'll have a higher GPA, and not that you'll have more successful relationships. Maybe that's true, but to be honest, within the Rabbeinu Yonah saying, he's not broadening it out that far. He's saying, if you're able to create this calculus in your head, you will not sin. Because what is any sin? Any sin is, again, I'm going to short-term want something, but long-term is a problem. It feels good now, but later there'll be consequences. When's that later? Okay, maybe he's talking about an Olam Haba. Maybe he's talking about even within this world, later there'll be a problem. But being careful here, he's talking at least right now in terms of sinning, not in terms of overall life skills. Continuing, ki yachshov schar aveira keneged hafseda. You're going to be able to consider the reward of an aveira. What's the reward of an aveira? It feels good, right? Keneged hafseda, in contrast to the long-term problem that's going to happen. It's important for us to think what is going to be the ultimate consequence of our actions. Now, he's broadening. He said, and all of your thoughts should be within this framework. So there's a limited sin aspect, but then a broadening of all your life should be through this prism. If you flip the page for a second. So now Rabbeinu Yonah, same commentator, is going to tell us about the flip side. What's the lo v've'eino mishalim? So Rabbi Shimon Omer, ha lo v've'eino mishalim, top of the page, lo haya yachol lomar bechlal hefech. He couldn't have said the opposite. So he's just remember, he's picking up, and whenever you read a commentator, and I've tried to mention this over and over and over again, we have to ask the questions ourselves. And now we understand, we don't even have to figure out what he's talking about. He's picking up on the problem within the Mishnah. Why is it that he doesn't just say the opposite and everybody else says, when everybody else says the opposite? So he says, Lo haya yachol lomar bechlal hefech. He couldn't have said the opposite. Right? What would be the opposite? Not foreseeing the future. Ki aroas anolot shisrach mimenu adam, shekol echad meruchak mimenu me'elav, aval yachol lidabek ba'al yidei ha'poal, v'lokach davar acher shiyesh lo adam laharos es hanolot. So I think, I'm not exactly 100% positive what he's saying. Maybe it's obvious to somebody else. But I think what he's saying is that you can't see you couldn't have said the opposite. It sounds like he's saying, shekol echad meruchak mimenu me'elav. It's like you should know that already. You should figure out that you should.
It's obvious.
Right? It's obvious. Right? So instead, he's going to give you an example. So what's the example? So end of the second line. Umisha eno roeu eno misrachek miderach ruach kimo halova veino mishalim shebishas hava yalo lachsho valiros imyuchal leparo lefaro kishiagia zmana piron. When you accepted the loan, you should have been able to foresee that you would not have been able to pay it back. And then he continues and he says, and if you can't figure that out, so you're going to run into problems. So why do you bring, he comments here, why do we bring God into this, right? He says, borrowing from man is like borrowing from God. So he elaborates here, we're not going to read this inside, but he basically says, maybe you're going to taina, maybe you're going to claim. So just picture it. Let's row S and Ola here. What's going to happen? I borrow now and I can't pay back. I don't have the money. So Beis Din's they're gonna bring me to Beis Din and say, pay back the loan. And I say, I don't have it. I say, okay, fine. Like, what are you gonna do? Right? So me as the borrower is thinking, like, I'm off the hook. I got Beis Din gave me the tour. I'm exempt. I don't have to pay it back. Everything's good. So even if you don't technically have to pay your friend back because you don't have the money, just remember, God's accounting for this also. There is a moral failing within your decision to take this loan, even though technically you can't pay it back and you're exempt from paying it back at this point in time. Okay, so that's Rabbi Yonah. There's more with what he says, but I think the main point that we want to bring out here is the ability to delay gratification, long-term consequences of averos versus a short-term pleasure. That's Rabbi Yonah's main point. If you go to source number 3 here, the Meiri says something fascinating as well. So the Beis HaBachir of the Meiri says, Amar Rav Shimon, Haroa es Hanolad. I'm sorry, there's no translations of these books, but I'll translate it as we go along. So Rav Shimon says, Haroa es Hanolad, Kemay Mar HaChacham Sha'amar Chavero Shal Adam Sichlo. So this is a nice phrase. So somebody, one wise person said, the friend of a person is his Seichel, right, his mind. Upal HaSeichel B'midosav V'hanhogosav Hushie roa esanolad b'chol davar shiasenu v'terem asiyas ha'pu'ula yizbonen ha'tachlis ha'roi latzeis mimeno. So similar concept to the Rabbeinu Yonah. The power of seichel, the power of our ability to think, is that we can foresee the consequences of our actions. V'chol asher yaseh kein lo yechta v'yishamu inyonav v'hanhogosav atzad ha'roi v'shalim. And if you're able to foresee it, you're not going to sin, and all of your actions will be in the right direction. So here's the part that he adds that I think is really interesting. He says, "B'kvar be'arnu b'ksas chiburenu ki darchei ha'etza dalad minim." He divides 4 different types of advice, 4 different types of what we would call. We'll see in a second what you would call it. I'll see if you recognize what this is. Let's look at the 4 and see if you can identify what he's talking about in sort of like contemporary language. So he says, number 1 here, his ha'echad, ha'hishtadlus shelo yehet sarich le'etza. The first level is your ability to work hard that you will not need advice. So you're able to plan accordingly that you know exactly what you need to do. Step 2, beis, ha'etza kodem asos ha'davar. There is the advice before something happens. Ha'gimel is ha'etza im ha'davar, the advice, the guidance as the thing is happening. V'ha'dalid his ha'etza achar ha'davar, the advice, the guidance after the thing has already happened. Keep reading, and he's going to give an example of what he means here. Kimosh shetomar derech mashal. So here's my mashal, here's my parable. B'inyan hanagas habrios b'derech harefua. So the Miri is a medieval commentator, but he's talking here about medicine. A lot of medieval Spanish commentators were doctors. Also, we know the Rambam, doctors of the Meiri, was also holding in medicine. I'm not sure if he was an actual doctor. I'm not sure what his biography is. But he's going to give us a mashal about refuah. V'derech ha-refuah sha'tov shebe'etzos. What's the best thing when it comes, if you're a doctor, what's the best advice you're going to give? Ha'chashuva ba'kodemes bizman uv'maylohu. What's the best advice? She'yis naheg bepas Bag uveyayin mishtav asher lo yitzka el behem bekamoto beichut. When you're eating, have a nutritious, balanced diet. Vianhig atzmo b'machalim kalim. Eat things that are easy to digest. Dakim b'tovim uveshir beinoni. Portion control. Uvizman roi va'azye batuach minacholim. And if you eat at the right time and you eat the right things and you eat the right amount, what's going to happen? You're not going to get sick. You're not going to need advice, right? You don't have an apple a day keeps a doctor away. This is the first thing you do is you plan beforehand, before there's a problem, prevent the problem altogether. V'habez, the next step is she'im nichshol b'zeh. Okay, we're all human. You mess up. You don't have the best diet. Sarach li tola atzmo etza b'mina anikoy barakus bizmanim yiduim terem yisyatzu acholayim lavo. So now you gotta start fixing it a little bit, cleansing. You gotta make up for it, balance out the mistakes that we've made. That's number 2. But v'hagimol yishtadal b'inyanei refuasa b'terem yishtaka acholi v'az tavo refuaso b'nakel. So you got to, again, the gimel is now, as it's happening, you got to work hard, you got to go on a diet, you got to eat healthy. And the dalet is, what's the problem? Is it already happened. You already got sick. V'adalet shim hisrashal v'inyacholi av lishtaket tzarech le'etz al koponim li'natza mehem b'minei refuas ha'chazakos. Now you need the real medicine. You need the real refuah. V'hamesumkanos. It's dangerous. V'chen b'gi. You got to get surgery. V'chen b'chol inyan v'inyan. He says this applies to everything. K'moshe kastavnu b'zu l'mata, like I explained in a different place. And this is what it means, haroes anolad. V'inyan haroes anolad, hu shi'ishtadal b'chol inyano, b'chlal ad shelo yitztarach le'etza, v'u shevach muflag l'chol inyan v'inyan b'chlal. This is a tremendous praise if you can incorporate this. What's the main idea? What is roes anolad? Again, it's not just cognitive, it's not just my ability to see, it's my ability to do things now that's going to prevent me from having to do things later. If I'm healthy now, I'm as a kid, as a teenager, as 30, 40, 50, and I'm doing now, I don't have to worry as much about the long-term consequences of not being healthy at this point. So that's his muscle in terms of the health, the food, the diet, but it's true, he says, about everything. To the extent that I can realize what I would call primary prevention, right? So if you want to extend this not just from dietary health, but in terms of mental health. So there was, I forgot the guy's name, but I saw a TED Talk once where some, I think this is simple, but we don't really think about it. He says, so you go to the dentist. Why do you go to the dentist? For the dentist, we know you got to check twice a year. Is anything wrong? No, I got to go check to go to the dentist. You go to the doctor once a year. Nothing's wrong. You still got to check, right? So he said, if hopefully we go, but but he says, this guy, I forgot the guy's name, but he said, why don't we do the same thing for mental health checkups? He says, how come we don't have a yearly visit to? It doesn't necessarily have to be a psychologist, but why don't we do a mental accounting to do our daily, weekly, monthly, just checking in? How am I feeling? What's my emotional state right now? And I think all of that, whether it's a dentist, the doctor, the mental health checkups, that's what's going on here. The primary prevention is before anything goes wrong, you're proactive to make sure to the best of your ability, obviously not everything's in our ability, to make sure that everything is going to be as best as it possibly can be. So that's the Me'iri, that's primary prevention, that's Haroa Es Hanolad. Make sense? Good. Yeah. Yeah. Again, he's giving a mushal. He's giving a parable, a metaphor when it comes to digestive and I'm extending it to mental health. But you're right. The essential aspect probably is in terms of how do you deal with sin, right? And in order to prevent sin from happening, your best bet is to avoid it from happening altogether, right? Your best bet is that primary, making sure that there's no enticement, that I'm not going to places that are going to convince me or lead me. That's Roas Anolad. I know at some point, if I go down this road, I am going to sin, right? It's not right before it happens, but it's 5 minutes, it's 10 minutes. It's a place, right? So if I know that, Roas Anolad is stay away from that. Avoid that whole confrontation. Okay. Source number 5. We're going to do two more main points. And we'll get to the chimpanzee sheet in a second. Just the chimpanzee sheet, just to be clear, is the article above what we're doing. So we're not talking about chimpanzees. They're tips, but there's primary prevention, there's secondary prevention, there's tertiary prevention, right? So that's the point, is you try to get things before it's even a problem, right? Our healthcare system would be so much better if we weren't treating people after they're already sick, but figuring out a way to prevent that from happening. That's what the Me'iri is saying. Let's figure out a way. Again, this is bigger than just me. This is a culture. This is a society. Let's figure out a way that we don't have to treat people after they're sick, but let's prevent them from getting sick in the first place. Yeah. Locus of control is the sense that I'm in control, and I'm not in, not the as Rabbi Soloveitchik says, that I am an object, not a subject. Right? I'm not being acted upon. This is actually Rabbi Shachter talked about with Yitzchak yesterday during the drasha. You weren't there, but he said that that Yitzchak is passive. He's submissive. He's the one who's acted upon. And contrast to Avram and to Yaakov, who are more active. But then, you know, again, you could have. We'll fill you in with the drush at a different point, but his point was that Yitzchak still had his thing. Okay, so let's do two more big ideas here. Source number five is the Pirkei Moshe. So he is medayik, he is careful, he does a careful reading here. And I alluded to this before. What does the word nolad mean? So Rosh Hashanah, nolad is past tense. Something happened. So there's a contradiction here. I know the cold right now is not because of me. It's because the heater, for some reason, isn't working. Okay, I did not request this cold. But the roa, there's a paradox here. Roa means to see. Nolad means what happened. Okay, good. So let's look in Pirkei Moshe here. Source number five. End of the second line. Fourth to last word on the end of the second line of source number five. It says, "V'lo amar haroa ma sheyulad." It should say, you should be able to foresee what will happen. Not what, you should foresee what has happened. Right? So Karen's saying it's because you're already, within your action, it's already precipitated. It's already sort of like in the world already by what you're doing. So he says something a little bit different. He says, "Rak haroa es hanolad lirmoz she'ein ra'ui she'yisha'era davar she'avo kefia yoso atid. Rak ki'ilu kvar nolad." You should visualize it as if it already happened. Ki yesh hefresh rav ben shtei ha'asharos. There's two different, there's a big difference between these two accounting, these two estimations. Ki b'yoso misha'er shekvar ba. Once you're able to visualize that it already happened, tiyeh ha'azara me'akishlon ba bepoel. Now it's an active thing that I'm doing. V'hu diktuk amiti v'nachon. He thinks this is a precise reading. Again, it's one thing to say, think about what's going to happen in the future. It's another thing to say, I have visualized and I have thought through and I fully have internalized what the consequences of my actions are. And I'm just going to give you a little bit of therapy technique here because I use this all the time. Right? So what are we really talking about in terms of Roes and Nolad? And we'll see this in this sheet in a few minutes. But humans are really the only species that can predict and think about the future. Right. So that's great. We can think about hopeful things. We can think about better days. But for most of us, most of the time, and probably this unique talent that we have about thinking of the future manifests itself in anxiety. Right? Right? What's going to happen? What will be? How will this turn out? Right? So when we have, and again, normal anxiety could be healthy at points in times. It motivates us to, more often than not, for most people, anxiety motivates us to be able to accomplish, to do, to foresee what, it's an indicator, an internal indicator. Did you foresee your actions? Are you thinking about this? And anxiety is actually a message to us that there's something that we need to focus on about the future. Now, where anxiety gets unhealthy is where it paralyzes, and instead of motivating us to fix and to deal with and to problem solve about how we're going to deal with the future, we end up becoming more paralyzed. We end up saying, I can't do this. And then we get, you know, physiological reactions, and we're not able to actually accomplish the things that we want to accomplish because we're so nervous. So one of the things that I don't want to give too much. It's going to take too long to give a full background. So I'm going to pick pieces that are going to be enough for to understand at this point. Maybe in the future we'll talk about this in more detail. But just for now, so one of the things that creates an unhealthy anxiety is what a psychologist by the name of Albert Ellis called awfulizing. Right? So it's a made-up word, but from the word awful, is that when we think about the things that are going to happen in the future and the possible consequences of that, we think it's going to be completely 100% terrible, awful, catastrophic, end of the world. Right? It's going to be completely awful. if this thing happens. And when we think that way, it usually leads to unhealthy anxiety. So how do you combat that? It's a big program that you can go through in terms of, you know, lots of, a few weeks of therapy, but in terms of just one little thing to take away, is that if you can think through, do imagery to that worst case scenario that you are so terrified about, and you can imagine yourself living in that scenario and realizing that it will not be as catastrophic, awful, terrible that you think it's going to be. Not that it's going to be good necessarily, but that it's not going to be as debilitating, as awful as you think it is, then the anxiety in the current moment decreases. The basic idea is exactly what the Pirkei Moshe is saying, is that it's one thing to think about the future. It's another thing to imagine fully what that future will be. And when you have that skill to be able to do that, not that we know exactly what's going to happen, but when we see things through in our mind's eye, all of a sudden our state now becomes better. So just to give one muscle here, one example, student, you're talking about college students for a second. If I don't get into medical school, my life will be over. And it's not, a lot of, some people say that and they don't really mean it, but some people say that and they really mean it. If I don't get into medical school, I do not see any possible future. My mission in life is to be a doctor, and it's cutthroat out there, and it's really hard to do well pre-med. And if I don't get in, that will be terrible, awful, catastrophic. I don't see anything else that's going to happen after that. So what I would do with a student like that, or even adult, an adult or anybody who's dealing with a similar issue, that if this thing happens, if this person dies, if the, whatever it is, it's going to be so terrible and awful, it's going to be bad, but let's take a moment, this is hard to do depending on the context, and you have to do it right, let's take a moment to actually imagine that scenario. And what will you do in that scenario? And more often than not, people then, once that anxiety decreases, can figure out, oh, there's option B. I can do something else. I can figure it out. Not that that's the goal, but now without my anxiety, I actually have a better chance of reaching that goal. Right? So that's, I believe, maybe I'm reading too much into this, I believe that's what the Pirkei Moshe is saying. Haro'es hanolad is the ability not just to predict the future, but to imagine the future and figure out from that how you're going to live a better present and make a better decision at the current moment. Make sense? Good. Okay. Source number 6 is the last big point we're going to make. It's tied to source number 5 a little bit. Truth is, we actually don't have to read it inside. But the basic point of source number 6 is Tosfos Yontif says something that we hinted at both at the Rabbeinu Yonah and the Meiri, that this isn't just a limited sin idea, that if I do this, I will not sin. This is a broader theme. Right, Haro'es HaNolad is about all aspects of life. If you want to just see in the first line there, I guess we'll read the first line. About Iker Kavanas Haro'es HaNolad in source number 6, Humash HaMefarish Sofeh U'mabit, you're able to predict, you're able to envision. B'mesh Atid Liyot V'zeh B'chol Inyanav V'asakav. That's the point that we want to bring out. It's talking about everything. Everything you do. Your ability to see and predict the future. So now, I want to take, to get a little bit better at this, I want to take a few minutes to look at this handout over here. So this handout is a, on the bottom of the first page, it tells you the article. It's taken from Science Magazine 2007, written by a psychologist by the name of Daniel Gilbert and Timothy Wilson. So Daniel Gilbert, if anybody is listens to any sort of like social science podcasts or anything along those lines, he's pretty famous in the social science scene. He wrote a book called Stumbling Upon Happiness. He also, if anybody knows those Prudential commercials where they tell you about how you nobody accurately invests into their future appropriately. Like, you think you're going to need X money in retirement, but you usually undersell that. So he's actually the voice of those commercials because they recruited him because he is the psychologist who deals with our ability to predict the future. So he has a lot of research on how we generally are terrible at predicting our own futures. So when we talk about haroes hanolad, it's important to realize that there are actually skills and there are pitfalls that we can fall into that if we're aware of them, we might be able to avoid. So what things do humans in general mess up cognitively when we think about the future? What things do we mess up? So if you look here in this article, it's four pages here. Some of it's a little dense, some of it's not, so it's like medium dense. And we're not going to read the whole thing, but I do want to give you some excerpts over here. So starting in the... Let's start with the second page. We'll start with the top left of the second page, where the top says social cognition. Right? So the paragraph right under that. Anybody lost? It's four pages. Double-sided. So we're on the second side of the first page. What? Yeah, 1352. Okay. So he says here, humans have this ability to, again, there's some context we're missing because we're picking up in the middle, but it'll make sense in a second. But they also have another ability that extends their powers of foresight far beyond those of any other animal. And so some animals can see, quote unquote, the future, right? Squirrels, you know, start, getting their acorns ready, you know. So that there's some element of future with animals, but humans take it to the next level. Just as retrospection refers to our ability to re-experience the past, here's the important word, prospection refers to our ability to pre-experience the future by simulating it in our minds. So prospection is our ability to look into the future, to try to predict how we're going to experience it. So he continues, we know that chocolate pudding would taste better with cinnamon than dill. Right? Have you ever done that before? Or have you ever tasted chocolate with dill? No, necessarily, maybe. But you could imagine it. That's the prospection. You could imagine what experience is going to be like. That it would be painful to go an hour without blinking or a day without sitting. That winning the lottery would be more enjoyable than becoming paraplegic. And we know that these things, not because they've happened to us in the past, but because we can close our eyes, imagine these events, and pre-experience their hedonic consequences in the here and now. So that's our ability. That's a special human talent. But, he continues, unfortunately, the conclusions that we draw in this way aren't always right. Right? So we make so many mistakes. And the question is, what type of mistakes do we make? So there's some, for those of you interested in neuroscience and the brain and stuff like that, you can read that first paragraph, that next full paragraph, but we're going to skip that now for those of us who are not, we're just going to get lost in there. So go to the second column here. So same page, don't turn any pages. I don't want to hear pages turning. Second column, right to the right where we just were, and I bracketed it for you. First, it starts people. People mentally simulate future events, but how do they use those simulations to predict the event's hedonic consequences? As the mere thought of eating a liver popsicle reveals, mental simulations of the future can elicit hedonic reactions in the present. So a lot of you just felt disgusted, right? Just thinking about it made you feel disgusted. So we can feel something about the future. People use their immediate hedonic reactions to simulations as predictors of the hedonic reactions they are likely to have when the events they are simulating actually come about. So you just, your thought, that experience of the emotion of disgust about liver popsicles predicted, right? What are you basically saying? If I was eating that right now, I would be disgusted. People do not imagine feeling anxious while having a colonoscopy so much as they imagine a colonoscopy, feel anxious, and then take this anxiety as an indicator of the feelings they can expect to experience during the procedure itself. So So I'm thinking, I'm experiencing it in my mind, feel anxious, and now my mind is telling me that experience won't be good. That's why you're feeling anxious right now. Simulations allow people to preview events and to pre-feel the pleasures and pains those events will produce. A great deal has been learned in the past few years about the neural substrates. Don't forget about neural substrates. That's the brain stuff. Okay, so now, what mistakes do we make when we predict the future? So go to now the same page. Nope, turning pages. The bottom right, all the way in the bottom right of the page that we're on right now. That's, I put a number one over there. Right, so he's going to tell us about four mistakes that we make, and I think, again, I'm spending extra time on this because I think this is just a practical takeaway. This is like how our mind works and how we can actually be better at being Roa Es Hanola. So, yeah. Your past experiences help you predict what your future experiences will be.
If you never tasted liver, we wouldn't have that reaction.
To some extent, that's true. To some of it, I don't think I've ever tasted liver, and I'm still disgusted by liver. Right? But it could be that you were taught that way. It could be there are some things that are just inherent that way. You're right. Past experiences are involved in this. But that's not the focus now. We can predict, I don't want to get too personal here, but I've never gotten a colonoscopy, right? I can predict that I would not enjoy it, right? How do I know that? Right? Either way, my point here is that you don't have to experience something to be able to predict that you will like it or not like it. It's your ability to make that prediction might be based on past learning experiences, what you've heard from other people, etc. But it's still the point here that we're focusing on, at least, is our ability to predict a future mental state. So let's keep going. I want to do these four so we can finish on time. So number one here. So what mistakes do we make when predicting the future? So number one is simulations are unrepresentative. So what does this mean? So he explains, we naturally imagine our next dental appointment by remembering our last one. So Barbara, this is to your point. Memories are the building blocks of simulations, which is why amnesiacs, people who can't remember, who have trouble with retrospection, tend to have trouble with prospection as well. So if you can't remember, you have a hard time to predict. Of course, simulations cannot accurately represent the future if they are constructed from memories that don't accurately represent the past, right? So actually, Barbara, this is exactly your point. I need the past to be able to predict. But what's our problem about the past? We don't really remember everything. So research suggests that people often use unrepresentative memories as a basis for simulation. So we use only little pinpoints that aren't the whole piece. So he continues, for example, when people who have missed trains in the past are asked to imagine missing a train in the future, they tend to remember their worst train missing experience rather than their typical train missing experience. Right? So I've missed 10 trains. 8 out of 10 aren't that bad. I'll just get the next one. The 2 where I'm in a rush and the guy purposefully closed the door on my toe and then didn't let me reopen. So that's what I remember. I made that story up. But that's what I remember when I think about train missing experiences. So when I think, when you ask me, oh, imagine what it's going to be like missing that train tomorrow, I'm going to be like, oh, it's going to be terrible. But I'm not thinking about the other 8 times where it really wasn't so bad. They then use this unrepresentative memory to construct a simulation of their next train missing experience, which leads them to overestimate how painful the next train missing experience will be. And he quotes some other research. Again, I encourage you to read it on your own. This part is pretty easy to follow. That's the one mistake we make, is since we're basing it on the past, our memory of the past and the examples that we bring are usually not representative. Second mistake that we make, simulations are essentialized. What does this mean? When we imagine, quote, going to the theater next week, we don't imagine every detail of the event, but rather we imagine the essential features that define it. We imagine seeing a stage filled with actors, But we do not imagine parking the car, checking our coat, or finding the seat. The problem with omitting inessential features from simulations is that such features can profoundly influence our subsequent hedonic experience. Right? So when we think, I'm so excited, I'm going to see, Hamilton. Haven't seen it, but apparently that's what everybody wants to see. Right? So I'm so excited. What am I envisioning? I'm envisioning the stage. I'm envisioning the excitement. I'm not envisioning all the other details that are really difficult and that are really annoying. So we're taking an essential aspect, but not the unessential aspects when we think about it. Most events have a small set of extremely positive or negative essential features that define them, as well as a large set of both mildly positive and mildly negative inessential features that don't. The event's net hedonic effect is a weighted average of these. Because simulations omit inessential features, people tend to predict that good events will be better and bad events will be worse than they actually turn out to be. And an example, the young couple who simulate the joys of parenthood but fail to simulate the drudgery of diapers are unlikely to have the hedonic experience they imagined. So this is just, an important prediction that we make, that we do incorrectly. We think about the essential good or the essential bad, but not the sort of daily life aspects of it, the little parts of it, and those parts could have a really important effect on our experiences. Here, I think the message to take away is that you need to be able to think about those inessential aspects. And this is one of the things that I like to do at speeches at Sheva Brachos, or pre-wedding types of speeches, is to actually kill the mood and tell people this is not easy. That happiness and excitement that you have right now is great, but you need to be aware that that's not what life is about. It's part of it, and you shouldn't take that away, and you should try to increase it, but you have to be aware that relationships are difficult and they take learning, etc. Fine. So that's number two. I'll take questions in a moment. Let's just do number three and four, and then we'll call it a day. So three is the next column. The third mistake we make when predicting the future is simulations are abbreviated. If we imagined each and every moment of the events we were simulating, our simulations would take as long. Now, just don't get confused here. There's a diagram here. We're not going underneath the diagram. Okay? So we're going down. Our simulations would take as long, continuing, as the events themselves. Simulations are naturally abbreviated and represent just a few select moments of a future event. The moments they select tend to be the early ones. When people imagine what their lives would be like if they won the lottery or become paraplegic, they are more likely to imagine the first day than the 297th. The problem with imagining only the early moments of an event is that the hedonic reactions to events typically dissipate over time, which means that mental simulations tend to overrepresent the moments that evoke the most intense pleasure or pain. Here's the big takeaway about this message, and it's really important. We think that this thing will make us happy. This is the crux of his book, Stumbling Upon Happiness. We think this thing will make us terribly sad, and because of that, we shape our lives to attain this happy, what we think is going to make us happy, and stay far away from these things that are going to make us sad. And what ends up happening is that our predictions of what make us happy and our predictions of what make us sad are often true short term. I think the number of days they throw out there is something like 30 days or so before you habituate to whatever new, fun, exciting thing, event that happened. I got a brand new car. Awesome, amazing. I am happy. Not that I'm not happy and you shouldn't be happy about that. I am happy. But after 30 days, it's back to normal. You win the lottery. Great, awesome, amazing, happy. Then it goes back to normal. Right, the bad relationships you had before, and they're still bad relationships. Right, so the point here for us is that it's important to remember these things when we predict the future, so we make better decisions about what we want. Things that were so terrified, same point as before. Things were so terrified that it's going to make us so unhappy. It will. It might, short term, and then you adapt. Right. So that's number three. Last one, last page. Number four. So number four is a little complicated. Let's see if we can pull out just a simple point here. So number four on the last page, he says, as mentioned earlier, so we skipped this part. That's why it's a little, that might be a little bit complicated. Basically, let me see if I could. I don't think we're going to do this. Hold on. You know, we'll give the example. We'll skip because the first paragraph you need some more background information. It's going to take too long to go into. Go to the second paragraph and we'll just see his example right after, around five lines down, where it says 51. So right after where it says 51. So he says, for example, hungry people mistakenly expect to like eating spaghetti for breakfast the next day, and sated people mistakenly expect to dislike eating it for dinner the next day. And so we all have experienced this. When I'm hungry, I make bad predictions of what I'm going to want to eat, even when I'm not hungry. Right? So people, another example, people who have just exercised mistakenly expect to enjoy drinking water the next day more than do people who are about to exercise. So I just exercised, I'm thirsty, and now I'm asked to make a prediction about how much water I'm going to like to drink tomorrow. So I make my prediction of what I'm going to want tomorrow based on the context of where I am right now. And that's false, right? Because we're not going to be in the same state tomorrow. In both cases, people do not seem to realize that their present hunger and thirst are influencing their hedonic reactions to simulated future consumption. They ignore the fact that the contextual factors that are presently exerting an influence on at T1, forget about that, will not exert the same influences at T2. The main picture here, forget about T1, T2, you need a little more context for that. But the main point here is that the fourth mistake we make is that we predict our future desires based on how we're feeling at this present moment, which isn't always true. Our context changes. And because of that, we make bad predictions. So big picture here is that Rav Shimon tells us, Roes Anolad. Right? A big part of what it means to be human is the ability to foresee, predict, and then try to control ourselves, our decision making for the future. We saw that's true in the context of making sins versus not sins. We broadened it, delay of gratification, and we saw a little bit also in terms of the prospection, our ability to predict the future, which is a talent of ours as human beings. But if we're more aware of the mistakes that we make, I think we can be better off making decisions and guiding our life based on these more accurate representations of what life will be in the future.